don't yet have proof of your expertise. I shall have to test you before I part with any money, or anything else that belongs to this realm. The cloud will be down tonight, but I will check the Monday papers and look up the tides." The widow gazed at him impenetrably. "I'm not mistaken," she said. "I've an almanac, and I'm very skilled at reading it. The moon is waxing now above the cloud. It will be full by Monday night, and on Tuesday it will begin to wane. Next month will be a month without a moon." Conjunctions, in which poor impressions are restored, the invitations multiply, and the past rolls forward to touch the present hour. The Reverend Cal Devlin had remained in the dining room of the Palace Hotel until the middle hours of the afternoon, whereupon he began to feel thick-headed and slow, and his reading ceased to be profitable. Judging himself to be in need of fresh air, he drained his coffee, stowed his pamphlets, paid his bill, turned his collar up against the rain, and set off along the beachfront, heading north. The afternoon sun was bright above the cloud, lending to the scene a silvery glow that leached the sea of colour and picked out points of white light in the sand. The very raindrops seemed to shimmer in the air. The wind, blowing chill from the ocean, carried with it a pleasant, rusty smell. All this did much to dispel Devlin's torpor, and in very little time at all he was red-cheeked and smiling, his wide-brimmed hat clamped tight to his head with the palm of his hand. He decided to make the most of his perambulation and return to Hokitika via the high terrace of Sea View, the site of the future Hokitika jail and Devlin's own future residence. Upon gaining the crest of the hill, he turned, panting slightly, and was surprised to see that he was being pursued. A young man, clad only in a twill shirt and trousers, both of which were plastered wetly to his body, was ascending the track to the terrace at a great pace. The man's head was down, and he was not immediately identifiable. It was not until he came within 20 yards of Devlin that the latter recognized him. Why, he thought, it was the man from the Arahura Valley, the Maori man, friend of the late Crosby Wells. Cal Devlin had not trained as a missionary, and had not journeyed to New Zealand for that purpose. It had been quite to his surprise when he discovered that the New Testament had been translated into Maori some 20 years prior to his arrival. He was even more astonished to learn that the translation was available for public purchase at the stationers on George Street in Dunedin at a very reasonable price. Turning the pages of the translated document, Devlin had wondered how the holy message had been simplified, and at what cost. The unfamiliar words in their truncated alphabet seemed infantile to him, composed of repeating syllables and babble, unrecognizable, like the nonsense of a child. But in the next moment Devlin chastised himself, for what was his own Bible but a translation of another kind? He ought not to be so hasty or so prideful. In penance for his unvoiced doubt, he took out his pocketbook and made a careful note of some key verses from the Maori text. "Te aroha te atua, e aroha anatatau kia ia, no te ea ko ia kua matua aroha kia tatau. Ko ahau te huarahi te pono te ora, Pone 14:6," he wrote, and then, marvelling, "from the epistles of Paora." The translator had even changed the names. The Maori man looked up. Seeing Devlin standing on the ridge above him, he stopped, and from a distance of several yards they regarded each other, saying nothing. A sudden gust of wind flattened the tussock around where Devlin stood, blowing his hair back from his temples. "Good afternoon," he called.
"Good afternoon,"
returned the other, squinting slightly.
"I see that we are neither of us deterred by a spot of foul weather."
"Yes."
"The view is rather compromised. That's the only shame,"
Devlin added, throwing out his arm to include the shrouded vista before them.
"It seems that we might be anywhere on earth when the clouds come down, do you not think? I fancy that when they clear again, we shall find ourselves in an altogether different place."
The terrace of Sea View, aptly named, had a singular prospect of the ocean, which from this height was a featureless expanse, a fat band of uniform colour, with the sky a lighter shade of the same. The shoreline was not visible from the terrace, owing to the steepness of the cliff below. The edge gave out abruptly into a scree of loose stones and clay, and the blankness of this vista trisected into earth, water, air, with no trees to interrupt the level, and no contour to soften the shape of the land, alarmed one's senses to the point that one was soon compelled to turn one's back upon the ocean altogether, and to face the eastern mountains instead, which were obscured today by a shifting curtain of white cloud. Below the terrace, the clustered roofs of Hokitika gave way to the wide brown plain of the Hokitika River and the grey curve of the Spit. Beyond the river, the coastline bore away southward, blurring with haze and distance until it was swallowed absolutely by the mist.
"It is a good vantage," said the Maori man.
"It most certainly is. Though I must say that I have yet to come across a view I did not like in this country."
Devlin descended several steps, thrusting out his hand.
"Here, my name is Carl Devlin. I'm afraid I don't remember yours."
"Te rau taufari."
"Te rau taufari," Devlin repeated solemnly. "How do you do?"
Taufari was not familiar with this idiom, and paused to puzzle over it. While he was doing so, Devlin went on.
"You were a very good friend of Crosby Wells, I remember."
"His only friend," Taufari corrected.
"Ah, but even to have one good friend, a man should count himself lucky."
Taufari did not respond to this at once. After a moment he said,
"I taught him Kōrero Māori."
Devlin nodded.
"You shared your language. You shared the stories of your people. It is a fine friendship that is built from that kind of stone."
"Yes."
"You called Crosby Wells your brother," Devlin went on. "I remember it. You spoke the very word that night at the police camp, the night before his body was interred."
"It is a figure of speech."
"Yes, it is, but the sentiment behind it is very fine. Why did you say it, if not to say simply that you cared for the man and loved him as you would love your own? Brother is another word for love, I think. The love we choose to give, and gladly."
Taufari thought about this and then said,
"Some brothers you cannot choose."
"Ah," said Devlin. "No, indeed. We cannot choose our blood, can we? We cannot choose our families. Yes, you draw a nice distinction there. Very nice.